History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time to ask a few questions from some of our more experienced neighbors. More importantly, take a little time to listen intently and patiently. We're going to learn a lot. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, yeah, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. And so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that'll be the case today in Shaver Lake, California, where we have the privilege of visiting with 95-year-old Eugene Jacobson, or Jake, as everybody knows him around these parts. Shaver Lake is a beautiful place. Just driving up today, I'm seeing wildflowers on the hills everywhere, then the devastation that the Creek Fire left behind. Before I get into your childhood and your service in World War II, what do you appreciate about living in this little corner of the world here in Shaver Lake?
It was a real pleasure to move up here. You know, my wife and I retired from Vineyard in Salma, California, and we needed to move from there, and we were trying to decide where to go, and because my oldest son had MS, we needed to go up higher in the mountains than just the foothills because heat is hard on MS patients. And so we moved up here and found a home here and got interested in the church and been here and had a great time ever since, fishing and what have you, and did deer hunting before I moved up here, but since moved up here, I didn't.
I saw three deer on your porch when I walked in.
Oh, you did.
Well, I guess those are made out of wood. You probably put those together yourself.
Yeah.
Do you know any other 95-year-olds who still plow their own driveway?
No.
How often do you have to do that up here?
When it snows enough to make it worthwhile. Or you have to plow it to get out.
So you've had to do that once or twice this winter already?
Oh, yes. When that storm came through here a month or two ago, we were plowing it twice a day.
Ooh. Well, I'll have to get your secret a little bit later on, but let's go back in time a little bit. You're 95 now, but let's hear about the early years when you were growing up between Selma and Kingsburg in the 20s and 30s. What do you remember about your childhood?
Well, I was a puny little kid with asthma and couldn't do the normal things, and plus I'm a full-blooded Danish heritage, and I matured real slowly in high school. And, well, even when I went in the service, I probably weighed about 105 and was 5'7". And I delayed going in because I figured they weren't going to take me.
Because you weren't big enough?
Because I wasn't big enough and mature enough. And so my dad had a vineyard, and so I got deferred to help in the vineyard. And the draft board came out when the next year started and says, you know, you can be deferred. You don't have to go. And I says, no. I says, I want to go. And that time, everyone wanted to go. There's no question about it. And I'd have been real disappointed that I didn't go. But anyway, I did go. And they took me, and everyone surprised that I had gone. And so I got the basic training, and I had made up my mind beforehand that I was going to do everything they could do if possible. And so in the obstacle course, the sergeant finally stopped me. I tried a couple times to go over it and couldn't get in. He says, you can just go around it, you know. And I said, no, I said, I'm going to go over it. So I did, and went to basic training, and got a pass to go to town, and everyone was stopping me in town and says, what in the thunder are you doing in the service? You don't look a day over 16.
Well,
so that was the last time I went to town. I stayed at the PX and did that. You know, by the time I got into combat and ended up with the ribbons and combat badge and everything, I could prove to the world that I could make it.
I'm curious, even before that, because a lot of young people will listen to this, and young people who are 10, 12, 15, 18, and their world has changed in the last year, and you lived through some times where the world changed significantly, and even in your childhood, I mean, your early years, it's the Great Depression and the years coming out of the Depression. Were you aware of any of that? Are there some things you look back on and say, oh, that was that way because that's what was happening at the time?
No, I think we, you know what was going on. Your parents were having hard times, you know, as far as being able to make money and danger of losing the ranch and what have you. And so you knew that was that. And you learned to frugal in, you know, and how you spent money. You didn't just spend it foolishly. You learned that. And I still have trouble today, still, you know, just unless something's really worth it, don't spend it.
That discipline sticks with you. And growing up around a raisin vineyard, how early did you have to get involved in the work of that vineyard?
Well, because I had asthma so badly, I couldn't go out in the field and dust and animals and everything. But by the time I graduated from high school, I was outgrowing asthma. I didn't have it anymore and went into the service, and they asked if he had asthma, and I says no, because I didn't want to be turned down. So I didn't tell them the truth, but I never had it since then.
How about that? And do you remember as a kid having an idea in your head, a dream, an ambition, something like, you know, when I grow up, here's what I want to do with my life?
No, I really didn't. I just enjoying life and taking it. I didn't have any thing what I was going to do. And growing up in the vineyard, I decided that I'll never be a farmer. I went to the service and got limited duty and had some hindrance after being wounded. And so I went on the job training and got a job in Fresno at a plastic manufacturing company and enjoyed it and everything, and ended up cutting at the end of my two fingers off. And so being that happened on the job training, they considered the same as a war disability along with what I've gotten a tendon cut in my other hand. And so they increased my payment too for being wounded. But I went there and I ended up cutting my two fingers. I said, well, maybe farming isn't so bad after all, you know. And so I ended up getting a farm and making raisins like my dad had done. So,
well, and you know, for folks who don't live around Central California, they've probably heard the line in the Broadway musical about you get your raisins from Fresno. But if they drive through Selma, they know it's Selma who claims raisin capital of the world. Yeah. Is that a source of pride for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I enjoy it. And they used to have the dancing raisins room and the cars would come out. So it was good.
Do you have a favorite variety of raisin that you grew?
Yeah, was Sun-Made.
Uh-huh.
I always belonged to Sun-Made all the time. My dad did, and one of the reasons, because you don't have to try to figure out the price you're going to get, because Sun-Made is a co-op, and you put it in there. Mm-hmm. The first year it's hard, because they just pay you a down payment, but after you're in for 1 year, it doesn't matter, because you're getting last year's payment in the next year.
Gotcha. And as far as the varieties of grapes, did you have some that you liked more than others, or did you only grow one?
I had both Muscats and Thompsons. Mm-hmm. And Thompson's what they make raisins out of. And so I have made raisins out of both of them. Muscats are bigger, taste different, and have seeds.
And a lot of people, I mean, I've been around the country a fair amount. There are people in other parts of the country who don't know there's more than one kind of raisin, right? But you can make a raisin out of any kind of grape.
Yep.
I like the Muscat raisins, and I like the flame grape raisins, too. That's a favorite of mine.
And the Thompson seeds, so they can make golden bleach.
Mm-hmm.
Different taste.
So having grown millions of raisins, do you still like to eat raisins?
Sure.
Is that part
and
of
you? Grapes.
Yeah, they're not bad when you pick them fresh either.
I know. And you wait until, you know, you've already picked them for raisins and you leave them on the vine, or a few of them that they leave.
Mm-hmm.
Get sweeter and sweeter and they get better and better.
Like candy on the vine, huh?
They are.
Well, while we're on the topic of the raisins, is there anything that, because you spent so much of your life in that business of growing raisins, is there anything that you think would be a misconception people have about raisins, or something you've heard that you say, no, that's not quite the way it is?
The best raisins are the kind that you just get through, dry them in the sun, and put them in the box and eat them. You don't send them to the co-op and they put water on them, and it ruins the taste as far as I'm concerned. The best raisins are just right out of the field, dirt and all.
Dirt and all.
Dirt and all.
That's part of your secret, huh?
Yeah.
Well, so you're going to high school, Selma High School, and December 7th, 1941 rolls around. Do you remember that day and how you found out what happened?
Yeah, our Baptist church was having in Barrels Park in Visalia. They have a park there. The church was having a Sunday school picnic down there that day after church. And on the way down there, we turned on the radio, and it was talking about Pearl Harbor. And so it was a real shock to us to know it was in, but I was on the way to the party.
And once you got there, I imagine that word was spreading around.
Yeah, it was all over, yeah.
Did you have any inkling at the time that this might be something you would have to personally get involved with?
No, you know, it was 41, and I still had 2 years of high school. I didn't know what was going on. You know, you're just wondering. But as it developed, the kids were, you know, in high school, the seniors were enlisting. And so I always wanted to, you know, and I didn't think would I get big enough to make it.
Yeah, so you said, you know, you have asthma, you're undersized, you're thinking the Army's not going to take me. Initially, they give you a deferment because all those soldiers overseas were getting raisins in their care packages, and somebody needed to grow the raisins for them to eat. And you could have stayed on the farm. You had another deferment. Yet you turned that down. You lied about your asthma. You're trying to put on weight so you're big enough to serve. Why was that so important? What was your motivation to get over there and be in the armed forces?
I don't really know, except that everyone was going, and your desire was to go to, you want to be a part of it. So it was more or less a wish or desire that you wanted to accomplish, and you wanted to prove to your classmates or to the world that you might be small, but your spirit was willing and wanted it.
And I'm not trying to make something there that isn't there, but it kind of sounds like maybe you felt you had something to prove. Were there guys that ribbed you or teased you about being small?
Well, you couldn't play sports. I mean, because you weren't big enough, football or basketball or, you know, anything. That was always the desire to be part of the group.
Yeah.
And when you couldn't do it, you wanted it all the more, I think. And luckily, I got into an old outfit in the Army. I mean, the 3rd Division had been clear at North Africa and Sicily and Italy and invasion of southern France. It didn't go in on D-Day. They were fighting in Italy in that. Mm-hmm. And so you went in, and it's an old outfit. And if you're going into combat, you want to go with an old outfit and not some fresh one out of the States.
Well, and you mentioned that. I mean, the 3rd Infantry Division has the record, I believe, for the most days in combat in World War II, 531 days. And you weren't in for all that. You weren't old enough yet. You weren't there yet. But tell me about when you first got into the Army and you go to basic training. You mentioned the obstacle course. Were there some other kind of welcome to the Army moments that you experienced?
Yeah, there's the thing that's different about, you know, you see the movies today, like that movie Fury. The guy comes as a replacement and they just downgrade him and, you know, grade him do things. And the 3rd Division, you go into it and most of the guys are, you have to be 19 before you could go overseas. And so all of us were just 19 and were shipped over. When you go into the outfit, they look after you. They don't downgrade you or anything. I went in and I looked young, and a platoon sergeant, we were back behind the line just across the river. They were going to take the next place. And I went in, and the platoon sergeant had a Tommy gun, and he handed me a gun, and he says, here's your new weapon, your first scout, a first squad, a first platoon. And so he gave it to me. And the second day out, he says, Jake, he says, I'm going to try to keep you alive. He says, you do whatever I do, lock on me. And if I run, you run. If I hit the ground, you hit the ground. And he had 36 other guys to take care of beside me. And yet somehow the Lord says, look after that guy. And so that I got to know him, and after I got hit, he was in the hospital too, and got to talk to him. After the war, I got his address and everything, wrote him and thanked him for taking care of me. But that's the kind of guys that I was used to, not like in the movies they have now, you know, where they're downgrading your force and they try to help you, they try to keep you alive.
And what was his name?
Pete Petronek.
And when you were getting ready to go overseas, was there any anxious thought that you had about what you were getting into or whether or not you'd ever come back to the States and see your family again?
No, that didn't enter my mind at that time. It wasn't until after you got in combat that you get three choices. You either get killed, or you get wounded, or you get captured. and you pray that you're going to get wounded. Very, very few outlive it.
And even I'm interested in every little element of this because I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You know, so you were 19 years old when right. you're heading overseas. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No.
And your hometown of Selma at that time, what do you think the population was?
It was probably several thousand, you know.
You probably had as many people on the ship or more than you had in your hometown, huh?
Yeah.
What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you?
They put us on an old English ship. That would be a luxury liner type of thing. And so we didn't go in a convoy. We took us 5 days to go across the Atlantic. We hit the rough seas, and all of us began to get seasick. I don't usually get seasick, but they said if you start getting seasick, get up, put a hammock and lay in it because it takes one motion out of it. You still go up and down, but you don't swing. And so I was started getting sick, so I got a hammock and put it up and went in it and went to sleep and woke up and everyone was sick and as ever headed for the latrine to throw out, but I didn't get sick.
I'll have to remember that if I ever end up in those circumstances.
Yeah.
And you know, you said something about the choices that you were going to have in an infantry outfit in Europe, and you said you pray that you would get wounded. Now, is that a figure of speech, or did you actually pray that specific prayer?
No, you prayed that. Lord, just help me. You know, if I'm going to get hit, why? I mean, you pray that you get hit. And you go in with a full company, usually. I mean, when we move down to where we're fighting in Benware, we're full company there. And by that evening, over half of my company was killed, captured, or wounded.
Mm.
But in the midst of that, you're a bunch of 19-year-old kids, except our platoon leader was he was an old man. He's probably 21 or 22.
An old man, yep.
But because your spirit is still there, you can enjoy it in spite of what goes on. You put so much adrenaline into your body, you shake all the time. But you can still live with it.
And he's living proof. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 95-year-old Jake Jacobson of Shaver Lake, California. For photos and a short video of Mr. Jacobson, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.